At a CME satellite series we conducted at the GI Cancer Symposium, we polled the audience concerning their interest in more information on different GI cancers, and by far the number one topic of interest was gastric cancer, almost certainly because of the landmark data set presented at the ASCO 2009 meeting by Dr. Eric Van Cutsem on the use of trastuzumab in HER2-positive gastric cancers. I met with Dr. Peter Enzinger to learn on his take of this historic data set, and he began by providing an overview of our current understanding of the biology of esophagogastric cancer.
One of the things that we have emphasized more and more is that esophageal and gastric cancer are a continuum. So we don't see it anymore as you have esophageal cancer or you have gastric cancer, because the reality is that most of the cancers are really centered around the GE junction, a little bit above, a little bit below, but more or less I would say that 80% of our cancers are somewhere in that area. So when you ask about what's new in esophageal and gastric cancer, I do tend to take the results of one and extrapolate them to the other. I think quite clearly in the last 6 months, and if you'll give me permission to extend that to ASCO last year, I would say that clearly the TOGA study was the most important new discovery for this disease.
And can you kind of go back in terms of what they looked at and what they saw?
Sure. The TOGA study was a study that included patients with gastric cancer, GE junction cancers, any cancer that involved the GE junction. And these patients were tested for HER2-new, and HER2-new testing is quite common in breast cancer, so it's easily extrapolated to this disease site as well. They looked at both immunohistochemistry as well as FISH testing. Patients who were IHC 3+ were included without FISH analysis, and if you had FISH analysis, you could have lower IHC involvement. About 20% of the patients who were tested, approximately just like in breast cancer, met the criteria for inclusion in the study, were high for HER2-new, and were randomized to standard platinum 5-FU therapy, and then randomized to either trastuzumab or placebo. And the study showed not only an improvement in response rate, greater than 10%, but more importantly showed about a 2-month improvement in overall survival. So for patients who now present with gastric GE junction cancer, and we're even testing patients with esophageal cancer because we think that there is no logic that suddenly the paradigm stops 5 centimeters above the GE junction. Any patient who presents with esophageal and gastric cancer, which is with an adenocarcinoma, we will now test for HER2-new. And the patients that test positive, when we use a 5-FU platinum strategy, we do add trastuzumab to the therapy.
How many people have you actually treated that way at this point?
Well, not that many, to be honest with you, in part because our group is very protocol-oriented, and we have been testing non-5-FU combinations in the frontline setting. We've recently completed a trial where we combined docetaxel, platinum, irinotecan, and bevacizumab, and we're now into a randomized phase 2 study where we're doing the same with or without docetaxel. But the patients that do move on to second line, or the patients who are treating de novo, particularly with FOLFOX, and in fact, none of us really like this platinum 5-FU, platinum capecitabine combination as much. We are extrapolating the data to FOLFOX, and those patients who test positive, we do add that. We've had probably about a handful of patients so far that we've treated that way.
What about the actual HER2 testing? My understanding is it's not exactly the same as the way they do the breast, or interpreted the same as breast, or what's the deal there?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There seems to be greater heterogeneity in gastric cancer samples. So depending on where you sample the tumor, there seems to be differences in the positivity and strength of the staining. The other thing is that although in breast cancer, we know that you have to be 3+ or FISH positive, it's less certain in gastric cancer exactly where to draw the line. There is data from the TOGA study that suggests that IH2+ patients may benefit similarly as the patients with higher positivity. And frankly, the number of patients included with lower numbers of positivity make it uncertain if those patients might respond as well. And I've been arguing to include patients with lower positivity in ongoing studies simply because the breast paradigm may not necessarily apply to esophagogastric cancer. And it's very hard to convince the breast oncologists of this who sit on our SRC and other review committees because it's become really so standardized and so ingrained for many oncologists that you have to have this 3+ that thinking otherwise is almost heretical.
Although, speaking of that, I mean, you know, there are data suggesting that maybe in the adjuvant setting, patients with breast cancer who are HER2 normal benefit. You know, that's going to be tested in a trial, but not everybody buys into that. So the actual test itself is the same, right?
Yes. No, it's absolutely, we use the...
It's how you interpret it.
Well, I think the interpretation is the same. I think that there is greater variability. I think, I'm not a pathologist, but my pathologist tells me that when he looks at a gastric cancer sample, there will be areas within the tumor that stain very lightly and other areas that stain very intensely. Whereas in breast cancer, he states that the staining is more homogeneous. So it's more difficult to come up with a number in gastric cancer because you have to probably average 3 or 5 fields or how many fields they look at. Whereas in breast cancer, probably the staining intensity is fairly similar across the sample area.
Any advice to an oncologist in community-based practice about how to deal with this? I mean, should they be talking to their pathologist, or what do they do?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the main issues is that Roche has been very much involved in purchasing Genentech and consolidating this merger. And in my opinion, I suspect that that has perhaps slowed down the process of moving trastuzumab to FDA approval. I've asked representatives at Roche where they are in the process, and they can tell me where they are in Europe with this process, but they have not been able to get back to me as to where they are with FDA submission of this. So I think that for a private oncologist and getting this reimbursed, after all, it is a very expensive medication, may be a little bit dicey. And I think that might be the primary consideration at this point, is that we haven't moved this along far enough yet that in the community I would feel comfortable that this is going to get reimbursed.
And what about in your situation?
Well, you know, I think that the Farber prides itself on being on the cutting edge of these new developments. And we used to be able to, when I first started at the Farber, I was told that we were one of 8 institutions that were approved for using any FDA-approved drug for any indication whatsoever. And that has shifted, really, to the last few years, where we've been told that we need to demonstrate in peer-reviewed literature that there is a benefit to a particular medication to be able to use it. So I think probably the requirements at Dana-Farber are less stringent than, say, the 5 formularies that are now being used by many insurance companies. And I think we're aided by the fact that Massachusetts is very patient-friendly. The insurance companies probably have more difficulty fighting something like this than in other states. But we are certainly restricted as well, and I think that we now have to really prove that there is a survival benefit or some sort of valuable benefit for the patients to be able to use these new medications.
Can you put in perspective what your take is on the amount of benefit? Do you feel it's clinically relevant?
Yes, I do. I think that the benefit is similar to what we would see with bevacizumab in colorectal cancer. Again, in colorectal cancer, it's about a 10% improvement in response rate. The Hurwitz study had 4-month improvement in survival. But on the other hand, the Salt-Cassidy study had only a 1.9-month improvement. So I think that the benefit is similar and certainly greater than what we saw with erlotinib in pancreas cancer.
Where are things heading in terms of research looking at this issue?
Yeah, so this evening, Dr. Cunningham will be joining us, and their group is looking at adding these molecular biologics on a grand scale in randomized studies, and the Europeans are doing that as well. For bevacizumab, the Avogast study is going to be particularly important.
What's that?
The Avogast study is a study that looks at platinum capecitabine plus minus bevacizumab. And then for cetuximab, we're going to be seeing a study called EXPAND, which is also platinum 5-FU plus minus cetuximab.
That's in KRAS wild?
It is in KRAS wild because in esophagogastric cancer, only 4% of tumors are KRAS mutant. So it's not really relevant. The mutational status is not really relevant in esophageal and gastric cancer as it is in, say, colorectal cancer.
What do we know about those two biologics in gastric cancer, Bev and cetuximab?
Well, right now we only have phase two studies that have been completed. I think what we know is that both agents are safe and reasonably well tolerated. But what we don't know right now is if there is a survival benefit that is worthwhile. What we do have are studies like ours where we gave standard chemotherapy a number of years ago, and now we've basically done the same regimen plus bevacizumab, and the results appear to be better. Now, the question, of course, is, are the patient cohorts comparable? Have we found better ways of salvaging our patients, better supportive care measures? But there's one study by David Ilson, which was irinotecan and cisplatin, and then there was a study by Manish Shah, which was irinotecan, cisplatin, bevacizumab, and the results were better. Our own study, we looked at docetaxel, platinum, and irinotecan, and had very good results. And then we did the same study with bevacizumab, and the results were better. There are studies looking at docetaxel monotherapy, and then we did a study looking at docetaxel plus bevacizumab, and the results appear to be better. So all of this is promising data, but really it's going to take these large randomized European studies to tell us if this is true or not.
So with all this activity looking at Bev and cetuximab, where is trastuzumab going to fit in?
It's more difficult to develop a drug that only can be used in 1 out of 5 patients than bevacizumab or cetuximab, which could potentially be used for all patients. So if you see a similar benefit in the Avogast study as you did in the TOGA study, it's going to be much easier to use bevacizumab than it is trastuzumab, because without having to do any testing, you can give bevacizumab to everybody. Whereas with trastuzumab, you first have to do the testing, and then only 1 out of 5 patients will test, and so it's much more difficult.
Although, you know, particularly compared to EGFR inhibition, you would think trastuzumab is going to be a lot easier on the patient.
Correct. Based on the TOGA study, we know that it's well tolerated in combination with cisplatin and 5-FU. What will be interesting to see is if Avogast is positive, if bevacizumab has a benefit, will one then give double antibody therapy of both bevacizumab and trastuzumab? Talking about an expensive regimen, that's going to be a killer.
Well, actually, that regimen is being looked at in the adjuvant setting in breast cancer.
Correct, right. Pegram and colleagues have looked at that. And in fact, they've made it even more expensive, I think, by adding lapatinib and another one that was at San Antonio, right?
Right. One more thing about, just to finish out on this TOGA story, I guess the other thing that came up is what the frequency is of HER2 positivity. You've already talked about some of the issues about that. But another thing that was presented with the TOGA stuff was the idea of the geographic variation and also the histopathology, the diffuse type. Can you go through that a little bit?
Well, what I do know is that it seems that the positivity was higher at the GE junction than it was down in the lower stomach. And I think that there is no data to my knowledge other than there is some smaller studies that have looked at esophageal and have found similar numbers as well. So I think that as with KRAS testing, there's going to be some variability from site to site or even in large randomized studies. So I think that I wouldn't read too much into that. I wouldn't necessarily say that esophageal cancer has a higher rate of positivity than gastric cancer, but that's what the TOGA study showed. I think that patients should be tested. We've looked at our first 40 patients with as I told you earlier, we're looking now to see which patients are HER2 new positive, to see which ones we can give trastuzumab to. And we found about the same rate of positivity in our patients as well. So I think it's probably going to be 20%. In some hands, it might be a little bit higher. In others, it might be a little bit lower.
One more question about esophagogastric. What about the issue of patients who have locally unresectable disease, their management, and even defining that in terms of how you do that?
Well, again, the situation has been complicated dramatically as of January 1st with the new AJCC staging system. Previously, it was a fairly simple staging system for both adenocarcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. You either had nodal positivity or you didn't. It was a straight T1 through 4 classification. There was this special thing about celiac involvement or not. And now we're moving to, you have to determine if they're squamous cell carcinoma or they're adenocarcinoma. It's the number of lymph nodes that are involved. You got N1, N2, N3. Grade is included in the staging system. And we're also seeing location being included in this staging system. So there are 4 or 5 new variables that are being introduced in the staging system that were previously not present. So although I feel quite comfortable telling you stage by stage what I would do for a patient with localized esophageal cancer based on the 6th edition, I haven't actually had enough time yet with the 7th edition to tell you exactly with the new stages what I would recommend. I think, honestly, it's more of a bookkeeping issue in many ways. If a patient has metastatic disease, it's quite obvious that they require palliative chemotherapy. But one of the major changes that we've seen is that the celiac lymph nodes have been declassified. And previously, what we had was if it was localized with regional lymphadenopathy, patients could get surgery or chemoradiation therapy or both. And if they had celiac lymph node involvement, it was thought that the prognosis was so poor that patients would undergo chemoradiation therapy alone and one really wouldn't go to surgery. And then finally, obviously, if you had M1B disease, patients with metastatic disease obviously got palliative chemotherapy. Now what we're seeing is that the celiac lymph node has not been given a special status anymore. And I think in part that has to do with the fact that we're really seeing a continuum and really what is a GE junction tumor versus an esophageal tumor versus a gastric tumor. Because after all, if you use the gastric classification, the lymph node status is not as defined as it is in esophageal cancer. So I think we're going to have to readjust a little bit exactly how we stage our patients and then decide how we're going to treat them. I think the bottom line, though, is that if enlarged lymph nodes by PET and by other staging methods can be encompassed in a radiation field, those patients should be treated with locally aggressive therapy, and you can make a determination on surgery based on exactly how extensive this lymphadenopathy is. If there's evidence of metastatic disease, obviously patients have to get palliative chemotherapy.
What about palliative surgery? How often is that done?
Yeah, it used to be done. This cancer is so aggressive that by the time patients recover from their surgery, they have extensive metastases, and there's really no clinical benefit to doing that.
Now, in patients who are going to get chemoradiation therapy or who, say, aren't going to get surgery, what about using induction chemo first?
Yeah, so we will often use induction chemotherapy in patients where we're uncertain if they have metastatic disease or not. It allows us an observation period. Also, it's helpful in bulky disease. Radiation therapy has been shown in many diseases to be more effective the smaller the tumor volume is. And if you can shrink this down and then follow that with chemoradiation therapy, you're going to have, in theory, at least a better outcome. But I think that overall, induction chemotherapy is something that has not generally been used. People have typically given the RTOG regimen and then followed it with surgery. The recently closed and now reopened CLGB study includes induction chemotherapy, but it's not been a standard approach for the most part.
Any other issues in esophagogastric we haven't talked about that you get a lot of questions about?
One of the questions is how to palliate the dysphagia. And there are a lot of patients who develop dysphagia. And the question is, should I put in a stent? Should I radiate this? Should I do photodynamic therapy? Should I give brachytherapy? And I think that One of the things that needs to be considered is exactly where the stricture is. The lower down it is, particularly if it's involving the GE junction, a stent will often pry open that area and will allow for reflux of acid, and often patients complain of a lot of discomfort from that. The other issue is that if you have a very bulky tumor, it's very hard to inflate that stent and to create an adequate passage. Also, often if you're really forcing that expansion of the esophagus, there can be a significant amount of pain related to this, and I've had patients with a lot of pain. My preference in general, if there is time, is to give radiation therapy as a palliative measure for dysphagia, and we generally can give a short course of about 3 weeks, in some cases even 2 weeks, to significantly palliate these patients. The other, I would say also, that brachytherapy has been rather difficult to use. It often doesn't palliate the patients. It often causes significant mucosal erosions and a lot of discomfort. Not something that I would use, and certainly not recommend for somebody who doesn't have a lot of experience with it. And photodynamic therapy really, although it does have some palliative benefits, really has seen less and less use, in part because the penetration of the treatment is so minimal that it actually doesn't offer any long-lasting benefits.